This is Yin Radio. These are the sounds from the Sravasti Abbey. And on Yin Radio today, we have a wonderful interview with the Venerable Thubten Shodron. And let me just go ahead and give you a little bit of background information. So she was born in Chicago in 1950, grew up near Los Angeles. She graduated with a BA in history from the University of California at Los Angeles in 1971. After traveling through Europe, North Africa, and Asia for 1.5 years, she received a teaching credential and went to the University of Southern California to do postgraduate work in education while working as a teacher in the Los Angeles City School System. In 1975, she attended a meditation course given by the Venerable Lama Yeshe and Venerable Zopa Rinpoche, and subsequently went to Kopan Monastery in Nepal to continue to study and practice the Buddhist teachings. In 1977, she was ordained as a Buddhist nun by Kyabje Ling Rinpoche in Dharamsala, India. And in 1986, she received Bhikshuni, which is full ordination, in Taiwan. She studied and practiced Buddhism of the Tibetan tradition for many years in India and Nepal under the guidance of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Chenchap Serkan Rinpoche, Zopa Rinpoche, and other Tibetan masters. She directed the spiritual program at Lama Tsong Kapa Institute in Italy for nearly 2 years and studied 3 years at the Dorje Palma Monastery in France. Was also resident teacher at Amitabha Buddhist Center in Singapore, and for 10 years she was resident teacher at Dharma Friendship Foundation in Seattle. Venerable Thubten Shodron was a co-organizer of Life as Western Buddhist Nun and took part in the conferences of Western Buddhist teachers with H.H. the Dalai Lama in 1993 and 1994. Keen on interfaith dialogue, she was present during the Jewish delegation's visit to Dharamsala, India in 1990, which was the basis for Roger Kemenetz's The Jew in the Lotus, and attended the second Gethsemane encounter in 2002. She has also been present at several of the Mind Life conferences in which H.H. the Dalai Lama dialogues with Western scientists and regularly attends the annual Western Buddhist monastic gatherings. She is active in Dharma outreach to people who are incarcerated in prisons. Venerable Shodron travels worldwide to teach the Dharma. North America, Latin America, Israel, Singapore, Malaysia, India, and the former Soviet countries. Seeing the importance and necessity of a monastery for Westerners living in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, she founded the Sravasti Abbey, a Buddhist monastic community in Washington State, USA, and is currently the abbess there. And this is just north of us here around the Newport, Washington area. Her books include Don't Believe Everything You Think, Open Heart, Clear Mind, Taming the Mind, Buddhism for Beginners, and many others. The Venerable Shodron emphasizes the practical application of Buddhist teachings in our daily lives and is especially skilled at explaining them in ways easily understood and practiced by Westerners. She is well known for her warm, humorous, and lucid teachings. And again, you're listening to Yin Radio here on KRFP Moscow Pullman. My name is Tara K. Howe. I'll be your host today. And what you heard at the outset there, the sounds we were listening to, are sounds from the abbey itself, from chants that were being done while our Yin correspondent, Eva Havik, was at the abbey. And so this is also an exciting day because in the tradition of Yin Radio, which is women's voices, women's stories, we're also recognizing as part of that having many women's voices to tell these stories. And so bringing on more correspondence means, of course, more perspective, more outreach, different interests in stories. And I really can't imagine two more wonderful people to come together for this interview. And so I want to let you know a little more about Eva Jo Halvik. She was born on Cinco de Mayo, celebrating freedom in the summer of love in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. She felt the urge to see the world and join the U.S. Peace Corps after graduating from the University of Idaho in creative writing in 1989. She realized the responsibility of being born in a resource-rich country and wanted to do what she could to help relieve suffering in the world. She has spent 20 years as a licensed massage therapist studying inward and outward to help get to and relieve the root of suffering, helping to bring peace to the world one person at a time. Freedom, peace, equanimity, love, creativity, health, animals, earth, and truth are some of the things that Eva feels are most important. She was on the founding board of directors for KRFP for 3 years before it was on the air. She believes it is extremely important to maintain free, open, and alternative speech on our free airways, while most of our free airways are being gobbled up by commercialism. KRFP, as I have also mentioned before, is a rare and very important broadcast, one of the most liberal stations in the U.S. Eva first moved to Moscow when she came to the U of I in 1985. She had her first radio program at KUOI her freshman year from 2 to 6 a.m., and Peter Basowa, as many of you will remember, a great radio figure from Moscow and KUOI, hooked a bungee cord on her when she first left for the Peace Corps in 1990. He said, "Moscow doesn't let people it loves get out of town for long, and an invisible bungee cord will pull you back." Sure enough, Eva just moved back to Moscow last June for her fourth time. The last 2 years she was living in Kauai, and yes, she does miss it, but while she was there, she missed it here. Eva feels like the Palouse Hills run through her veins like water and is happy to be home here again. Which is a beautiful tribute. And she describes, we were curious about the visit to the Abbey itself, so as I will play the interview here soon, you just get to hear this wonderful dialogue between these two gentle, wise women. But also to give a feeling of what it was like to be up at the Abbey, Eva has put together this beautiful description, which I'll read to you here. She says, "While visiting the Sravasti Abbey, the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I felt a breath of fresh air." So Eva went up to Newport, Washington from visiting her mom in the hometown of Coeur d'Alene. It was one of those days where everywhere that she looked felt like a gift of beauty. The further north she drove, the fuller the mountains grew as she was graciously being lifted from any concerns whatsoever. The Abbey sits on 280 acres, surrounded by mountains and more mountains and air and sky that felt to her like she was being held as a small child. She did record the sounds from the Abbey as we heard, but the other part, every time she listened, she said she heard peace. She says, "I heard the sound of the fresh snow gently resting on the boughs of trees, the boughs of trees. The sounds of my boots crunching the cold snowy ground was louder than anything. I witnessed a beautiful, kept, modest group of buildings with some statues of Buddha and Kuan Yin. The main building is very beautiful, and the mountain lodge feeling hall dedicated to the Chenrezig, also known as Kuan Yin, the Buddha of compassion. At the entrance, a statue with 1,000 arms reaches out to care for all living beings, and that is exactly how I felt there. The ordained nun, Dam Jo, was extremely helpful and gracious as she welcomed me and showed me around. A part of me that yearns for this simplistic style and devotion to love and truth was excited like a small child in a candy store. The sweetness of 1,000 lotuses graced my being even more when I sat next to the Venerable Chodron for lunch and then for our interview after. I felt lighthearted and happy and grateful for my time at the Sravasti Abbey with the Venerable Chodron, Damcho, and the rest of the nuns and monks. I also had a sweet exchange with another visitor that day that had driven up from Spokane seeking refuge after a Thanksgiving that stirred up familial trials. We were both grateful for how we could learn with each other about a way of peace and dedication in helping to relieve the suffering of all sentient beings and ourselves." So again, a beautiful introduction to this interview with the Venerable Thuten Chodron with Eva Jo Halvik. And I'm going to go ahead and play that for you here now. And I believe that you will love this as much as I have.
And... here we are with venerable.
Venerable.
Also vulnerable. Also vulnerable. Okay. And you're venerable, is it? Oh, good. We're starting with some good laughter. Children. Uh-huh. Thank you. And so can you please just introduce yourself and tell us your journey here?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I never know quite how to introduce myself. Right now, I'm living at Srivasti Abbey. It's a Buddhist monastic community up in Newport, Washington, in the middle of nowhere. And I guess you would say I'm the founder and the abbess. But my journey, my Buddhist journey anyway, started way back, yeah. And I guess I should talk a little bit about the kind of child I was, because that sets the stage for the interest. So I grew up I was a 60s kid. I was born in 1950. And, grew up in the middle of I was in high school during the Vietnam War, high school and college in the Vietnam War. And the Watts riots I grew up in Southern California, so they were not too far away. And the women's movement was just starting. So it was a very special time in America, I think, where people were questioning a lot of things. And I was questioning a lot of things personally, in any case, wondering what the purpose of my life is and why am I here. My grandparents were immigrants to the country. My parents made the American dream. And the American dream just didn't kind of do it for me. It wasn't satisfying for me. But I really didn't know what else there was. And so I had these kind of spiritual questions. And especially during when the war was going on, they were saying, we're fighting so we can live in peace. And I'm going, what? We're killing people so that we can live in peace? This doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And then, what was going on in the South with the freedom movement and trying to register voters. And I'm a kid and I'm going, wait, it says here that, everybody can vote. How come those people can't vote? And how come we're judging them based on the color of their skin? This isn't what they taught me in fourth grade that the country was about. Yeah.
Right.
And then same with the women's movement, kind of. My mom was a housewife because that's what everybody in her generation did. But she was a very bright woman, and I'm sure if she had had the opportunity, she would have been a lawyer and probably a very good one. You don't want to mess with my mom.
Right.
I was trying to figure this out because the values I was taught in school weren't matching the reality of what was going on around me,
right,
of how people were living. And I just didn't understand. And then also wondering, you grow up, you go to college, you do your thing and have your 2.5 children, or, maybe it's 2.1 nowadays, and then you grow old, and you have family meals in the middle of it, and you grow old, and then you die, and then what? What's the meaning of your life? Why was that life worth living? So I really had those kind of questions. I went to various religious groups and asked questions, and the answers they gave me didn't make any sense. I could never completely grasp the idea of a creator God. And I realized that that's an idea that works for many people, and I'm happy it works for them, and it gives them, a spiritual path and ethical conduct and all, but it just didn't work for me. So by the time I got to college, I you know, threw everything out and did what everybody else was doing. So you can fill in the blank.
In the 60s, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, and then, you know, I finished, my first 2 years were at USC. I went on a special program, and then I graduated from UCLA. As soon as I graduated, I went with my cousin and some friends in a big yellow bakery van that they redid, and we drove around the country and had a good time. And came back, and I, you know, I went to work in a school. Because I still think, you know, what's important in life? What's the meaning of life? And I thought it had must have something to do with benefiting others, but I didn't know what it was. So I figured education's a good way to benefit people. So I went to work at a school, and then in the meantime I got married. We returned most of our wedding presents and took the money, and then we went to Europe. And we traveled in Europe, North Africa, the Middle East. And in those days, it was 72, 73, you could go overland to India and Nepal. Mm-hmm. So we did. We traveled through Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan, Pakistan, into India and Nepal. And then when we ran out of money after a year and a half, then we came back to the States. And I went back to graduate school in education, and I also was teaching. I had my own classroom. My first classroom was in the inner city. That was really difficult. Yeah, and then I went to another school that was more mixed. Yeah, very. It was a wonderful school, actually. It had open classrooms and mixed kind of students and all. So then one summer vacation, I was a teacher, I had the summer off, so I was in a bookstore, Bodhi Bookstore in California, L.A., and I saw a flyer for a meditation course and some introductory talks by some Tibetan lamas in L.A. So I went to the talks, and then I decided to go to this course. It was for 3 weeks. I signed up for two because I didn't know if I'd like it or not. Wound up staying all three. And, you know, one of the first things they said, this is Lama Tupten Yeshe and Kemchi Zopa Rinpoche, and one of the first things they said is, you don't have to believe anything we think. So, well, that's very good. yeah. And so it wasn't like, you know, hallelujah, this makes so much sense, but it was like, you know, they said, you're intelligent people, think about it. So I thought about it. And as I thought about it, what they said, it made sense to me on an intellectual level, you know, because I was quite scientifically predisposed. And so that, it made sense to me on that level. But also when I practiced it, it really helped me, you know, with my emotions, with my, yeah, just my whole attitude and everything. Because before I started practicing Buddhism, I thought I was a pretty wonderful person. And then in the teachings, they talk about, you know, ignorance, anger, and attachment being the causes of suffering and selfishness and so on. And I started looking at myself and like, boy, I have every one of these mental afflictions. And as I started looking at my life and how I was acting towards other people, you know, I was not the sweetest person in the world. So I realized I had to do some serious kind of internal work and internal transformation. So after the 3 week course, I came back and I did a 1 week retreat while my husband went to Indiana where the lamas were giving another week long course. So when he came back, he also liked the teachings very much. But I thought, you know, I really want to learn more, and if I don't, I'm going to regret it. So I wanted to go to Nepal where they had a monastery. Because in those days, this was 75, there were hardly any Buddhist centers in the U.S. where they spoke English, and I didn't speak any other languages. Yeah. So
How many now are there in the U.S.?
Oh, there's many temples and centers and many English-speaking things. I can't give you a number,
excellent.
But there's lots.
Numerous, good.
Yeah, many, many. So, but at that time, there was hardly anything. So, you know, I said, I want to go back to Nepal. And we talked, and eventually he agreed. And so we went to Nepal. And they had a one-month course there, which we stayed for, and then we stayed on and, you know, took part in the community life. And so we were in India and Nepal for a bit over a year again, you know. And when we went back, my parents were this time going, oh, no, you know. We thought she'd gotten all of that out of her, and now she's going back again, and... and so it's strange because I knew rather quickly after I met the Buddhist teaching, the Dharma, that I wanted to ordain. I'm curious if I, at who I am now, could meet that person I was, what I would think of her. I would probably say, slow down, you know. But having been that person, I knew what I wanted to do.
And you were in your 20s at that time?
Yeah, I was 24 when I went to the first course. And then, you know, went to Nepal after that. And then I had asked my teacher if I could ordain. And he said, yes, but wait. And so I had to come back to the States and work things out. And so I was 26 when I ordained. So, you know, came back to the States, worked things out. My husband was great about the whole thing. I mean, he was really sad, but he didn't do any guilt trips. He didn't try and stop me in any way. And so now we're still friends. Yeah, my mother introduced him to somebody else.
Oh.
And they're married. They have three children.
Wow. So I don't know. So by becoming ordained... then that asked you to be a single person.
Yeah, you're celibate.
Right. Okay. From the moment you were ordained onward.
Onward, you're celibate. Mm-hmm. And if somebody had told me when I was 20 years old that I'd be celibate, I would have said, forget it.
Right,
you know?
Right. So did you get a divorce then?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We split up, and then that's how my mom introduced him to... somebody else.
So he didn't go on in his studies.
No. Well, he's a Buddhist.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And his wife is a Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Sometimes when His Holiness has taught in L.A., some years back I've gone down there and I stayed at their house and we all attended the teachings together.
Beautiful.
And he remained very close to my parents. Yeah. I was the black sheep in the whole family.
Right, right. Your story reminds me of the questions my mind has, you know. Gosh, you know, I've done some different things. How would my mother feel if I, you know, decided to come do this now?
And, mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting thought process that we have. And it's, to me, it feels what I'm hearing is you had something convicted inside of yourself that drew you in this path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of the search for finding your meaning in this life.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I think it's... I'm always so moved by people who devote so much of their lives to the path of of truth, of finding that truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, it is also a question, the celibacy, and you thought that might be a challenge as a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought twice about it?
Oh, well, sometimes I would, like, look at couples walking down the street and go, oh, I remember what that was like, you know. But then as soon as I thought about it, then I remembered really what it was like. It wasn't just the lovey-dovey moments, it was... everything else.
The drama.
Yes, the drama. The drama.
Right.
And so I never thought seriously about giving back my ordination.
Was there any question about having children for you?
You know, as a kid, I never liked to play with dolls. I thought it was boring. And I was never very interested in having kids. I probably would have, because that's what everybody did. But it wasn't something I had this strong feeling about, like, you know, I want to be a mother and I have to be a mother. So I've never really missed having kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some women, it's not the strong impulse.
Yeah. You know, and my parents were just like, what? You know, because for them, having children was so important. Mm-hmm. And it was like, no, I'm not really that interested.
And the feminism aspect of your journey in during that time, you were saying, in the 70s when it was really coming alive.
Yeah.
And as a person who was really seeking meaning and truth, did you say that what you were feeling with that movement was unsatisfactory or wasn't giving meaning?
You know, the feminist movement was really taking off just as I finished college. So there was no opportunity when I was doing undergraduate work to take women's courses. They didn't have them at that time. After I graduated, they started having them. But I did, after I graduated, I went to women's groups and consciousness raising and things like that. But I didn't find them satisfactory because the groups I went to, everybody talked about their relationships. And, you know, it was like the whole thing, yes, we're women and we want more empowerment, but, you know, here's my husband, boyfriend, significant other, and we have this problem and that problem, and they said this and I said that, and I have these emotions around it. And it was like, you know, it was just people getting together talking about their relationships, and I didn't...
That wasn't giving a lot of meaning.
Right, because I had my friends. I did that enough.
Right.
I did that too much, but with my friends, but I didn't need to go to a women's group to do it.
Right.
And then it was interesting, years later, when I was in the monastery, we had some, the nuns held some groups for the laywomen to come. And the laywomen, too, all the time talking about their relationships. And I just thought, wow, women define themselves in relationship to the men in their lives. Yeah?
Yeah.
And as much as we talk about women's lib, the primary thing, at least that I was exposed to, but this was, grant you, in the 70s.
Right.
And the 80s, it may have changed now, was, you know, people defining themselves in terms of their relationship to a man. And watching the women's movement, and still now, bottom line, in spite, there's been a lot of progress made, a whole lot of progress. But in the overall culture, bottom line, women are still a sex object. You know, and you're to, you know, not only advance in your career and do this and that, but you also have to be beautiful.
Right.
And you have to dress well. And if you're not beautiful and you don't dress well, something's wrong with you. You're not interesting. You could be bright as could be, but your brilliance is only recognized if you're also attractive.
Yes, yes. It still feels like there's a long ways to go as far as the equanimity of men and women.
Yeah. And this isn't just coming from the men.
No.
Women see themselves, ultimately, my value is being attractive to somebody else.
It's true. And is it because of the culture that we've lived in, more of a patriarchal world for thousands of years?
Or, you know, how much can, when we say patriarchy, it seems to put everything on the men.
Yes.
I think the position women are in is because women have bought into certain key concepts about who we're supposed to be. And we can't keep pointing the finger at the men and say, the men, you do this, and you keep me this, and you do this. But because if we buy into a certain view of who men are and who women are and what our capacity is and things, then we're playing along with it, and it's our thought process as much as the men's process, as much as the social structure and the structural, you know, way of
society. Yeah, right.
You know,
is I'm curious. I've studied just, you know, a little here and there about the different attributes of yin and yang, and, you know, we're talking about yin radio, and it's named that because we're focused on women and giving women voice and hearing women's stories. But also listening to, if I read the attributes of the yin and yang qualities, which could be quite confusing things here, but the masculine and feminine.
I have a hard time relating to that.
Okay,
You know? Sometimes, every once in a while, you know, I'll speak that kind of thing. Well, you know, men emotionally are more like this and women like that. But when I really look at it, I don't think it's true, you know? But when they say women are very emotional, I've seen men be incredibly emotional too.
Right.
Yeah. They may have a different way of showing it because of what they're conditioned.
What our society has
conditioned. But in terms of feeling and experiencing emotions and being hurt, being offended, being fickle, everything they attribute to women, the men have it too. Come on.
They do have it too, but it, like you say, because of our society, they haven't really felt like they had the opening or the space to allow that in a free and easy way, where it's more expected of women.
Yeah, it's expected of women, and then they criticize us for it.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. So there still is a ways to go for blending these yin-yang qualities, these men.
And what I find very interesting, you know, because I'm the president or abbess or whatever of the monastery, whenever there's an official letter from somebody who does not know me, it always starts, "Dear sir."
Yes.
People do not think of a woman being the head of a religious institution.
That's an interesting topic. So how does that feel for you?
I laugh at it now. Mm-hmm. You know, being in the West, I can laugh at it.
Yes.
When I was in Asia, it influenced me a lot in a not very productive way. You know, there were things said, but that wasn't the major thing. It was the whole attitude within the Tibetan culture and the religious hierarchy, the whole attitude, and what I saw around me, you know.
The attitude about what?
About women.
And what was that?
Women are less than, they aren't as intelligent. The whole Tibetan hierarchy is all men, and nobody thinks twice of it. Even nowadays, you know, when you go to South India for the big teachings and they award the Geshe degrees. The Geshe degrees all go to men. They're just starting next year. They may have some women Geshes for the first time. But everybody on the stage, except maybe two people, are men. All the graduates are men. Nobody thinks twice, right? You were there. Nobody thinks twice about it.
Do you think twice about it?
Yeah. But, you know, but nobody in Tibetan culture thinks twice about it. I don't know how many of the Westerners think twice about it. You know, I mean, I notice it because as a Buddhist, I grew up in Asia amidst that culture.
Okay, right.
And then I came back to the States and I realized that I had lost a lot of my self-confidence by being in that culture.
Oh, but in that culture.
Yeah, and so when I came back to the States, I had to regain some of my self-confidence.
As a woman. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So how, I mean, being a more masculine or more male tradition of a religion.
The hierarchy.
The hierarchy.
Is male.
Okay.
The religion is different from the hierarchy.
Very good point. Yeah. Can you just talk
about that? And I think this is a big problem.
Yeah.
Is people don't realize that the hierarchy and the religion are separate. And in some religions, Catholicism, Mormonism, they don't separate the religion and the hierarchy because the hierarchy is bestowed with special power
right.
from whoever the Almighty is. In Buddhism, we don't have a creator God
who
or anything
bestows
like that.
Upon anybody.
No.
Right.
Now, so the religion, you know, in terms of your spiritual practice, you have direct connection. And the values in Buddhism, you know, generally teach equanimity towards everybody, respecting all sentient beings and so on. Then religious institutions they exist within cultures, and cultures tend to be patriarchal. So the religious institution, you know, it's all for the man, by the man, and so on.
Interesting, okay. Right.
Yeah. But I came to Buddhism for the teachings, not for the religious institution. And so in the early years, I was kind of sad because, you know, it was quite apparent. I would never be part of this feeling of Tibetan Buddhism, simply because, not only because I was a woman, but because I was a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Still, you're not a total part of it. And at first, that was kind of, it made me sad. And then later on, I realized it was actually a big advantage.
How so?
Okay, how so? Because I could come back here and start a monastery. His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave permission. And the Tibetans don't really care because I'm not part of their institution. So they're not, you know, coming here and, you know, are you doing things this way? Are you doing things that way? Buddhism, in any case, isn't so much like that. It's
right.
not so top-heavy and looking down. And His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, certainly isn't a pope.
No.
And doesn't have the power of a pope. And doesn't want the power of a pope. But, you know, I figured out I had more freedom to try different things when I was here as a woman than if I was a Tibetan nun living in India in the Tibetan refugee community.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So what I'm interpreting is that there's more freedom to really embrace the teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Full on. No matter who you are, man, woman, no matter what color
yeah.
or anything.
Yeah, you can embrace the teachings.
Where the teachings in the culture of Tibet... Yeah,
everybody there can embrace the teachings, too. In terms of the teachings, you know, everybody
right, okay.
can embrace it. In terms of setting up a monastery, being a teacher oneself...
Okay.
In the Tibetan community... The only women who are teachers are relatives of very highly ranked men.
Right.
Okay. In the West, in the Tibetan tradition, women who are not relatives of highly ranked men can be teachers because we're not part of them
right.
so much. Okay. So, but in terms of my spiritual practice, I just, you know, I listen to the teachings and I practice them and I don't feel any hindrance there in terms of being a woman.
That's
yeah.
beautiful. So there's no question, like what you're saying, as far as your practice, your spiritual practice. And who you are
yeah.
here. And you have put to the side that the hierarchical system of
yeah.
the Buddhist tradition,
right.
it was never going to, like, you know, you're never going to be on stage next to His Holiness.
Of course not. But, you know, what I've done in my mind is I've separated my spiritual practice from the religious institution.
Right. Beautiful.
Okay?
Yes.
And so, although the Abbey, you could call a religious institution, okay, and it's, you know, we're Tibetan practitioners. We follow Tibetan Buddhism, okay? But you know, and we invite Tibetans to come here and teach, but they're completely happy with what we do. Whereas, like, if a Tibetan nun just went out and started her own abbey, mm-hmm. you know, unless she was a relative of a highly ranked man, the people would really raise eyebrows. And even for me, starting the abbey here, some Westerners did as well.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like the idea of, who are you? You're a Westerner, and you're a woman, and you're starting a monastery? Did your teacher tell you to do that? And then, you know, and then I had to say, well, I asked His Holiness's permission. He said, fine.
How many other women are in your role?
There's several Western women who teach.
Okay.
Yeah. But in terms of starting their own organizations, not so many.
The famous person who I know of is Pema Chodron.
Yes.
And are you an equal to...
I don't even think like that.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't even think like that. I highly respect Pema Chodron.
Yes. Is she teaching from a similar tradition as you?
Well, we're both Tibetan Buddhists.
Okay.
Within Tibetan Buddhism, she's a different tradition.
Okay.
But it's not a big deal.
Okay. I'm just, you know, she's somebody who is, again, popular, I would say, who has reached, you know, many.
A lot of people.
Yeah. And so it was curious to me, you know, where, like, how would I see you?
Well, see, we're not part of a religious institution. We don't have any ranks.
See, thank you so much. This is good.
So there's no ecclesiastical ranking.
Right.
We're both fully ordained, mm-hmm. you know. And in the Tibetan tradition, they don't have the lineage for full ordination. So both of us had to go to other Buddhist traditions to get our ordination.
Oh, and that's interesting. So which Buddhist tradition did you get your ordination?
I went to Taiwan.
Taiwan.
Yeah.
That's right. I read that in your biography.
Yeah, so I went to Taiwan. That's where most people go. Some Hong Kong, some to Vietnamese, but in Europe. Yeah.
And then India would be another option?
No. I mean, there have been a few bhikshuni ordinations in India, but only when... maybe the Taiwanese have come and organized a big ordination.
Right.
Okay. But there aren't so many Buddhism in India, that's a whole other story.
Yes.
Okay.
It's been going on for many, how many years you guess? Thousands?
Yeah, I mean, the Buddha lived 26 centuries ago. So
right.
Quite a while.
Beautiful. Yeah. Wow.
So this whole thing about being a woman, I don't like to think, you know, I am a woman, therefore I must act like ABC, you know, or I must do ABC. You know, in terms of forming my self-image, I don't want to be limited in that way.
Right.
You know, when I go back to India and I'm with the Tibetans, I act like a nun acts.
Right. In Tibet. Tibetan nun would act.
Right. Well, no, not exactly like a Tibetan nun. But, see, the Tibetan nuns themselves have actually changed. When I first went there in 75, the Tibetan nuns were so shy. They didn't have very much education. They were very shy. Now, they're... You know, like I said, next year we'll have the first female geshes, which is a huge step in the Tibetan community.
And how, can you explain a little bit about that?
It's like a PhD degree.
Oh, fabulous. Okay.
Yeah. So we'll have some women who have done that. So that's a really big thing. But even the way the nuns have acted have changed a lot since I was there and, you know, in the 70s until now. The women have a much better education. They're much more responsible. Some of them are learning foreign languages and are starting to learn about the outside world. Yeah, and they're learning to speak up a little bit more. But they don't have the full ordination. Their teachers are mostly men, although now we're starting to have some Tibetan nuns who are teachers teaching in the nunneries, which is wonderful.
Yes.
It's a really new thing.
I feel it's wonderful. And why do you feel it's so wonderful?
Because I think Buddha's teachings have so much to offer all living beings, so all living beings should have access to them. And everybody should be able to use their potential.
And as a teacher, that each individual, like a woman teacher, will bring something different than a man teacher would just...
Well, some people say that. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know, but maybe. But you know, I mean, because I see it as being a woman, my body is a package.
Yes.
You know, it's the guest house I live in for a few short years. It's not who I am.
No.
You know, and when you talk about your mind, your consciousness, you know, that's something formless. That's not male or female.
And is that who you would... Could you talk a little bit on who you would think you are? Who are you?
Well, in Buddhism, we're trying to figure out who we aren't.
Aha.
Not who we are.
Aha.
The idea being that we have so many, many, many ideas about who we are and so many identities that we put on ourselves, and grasping at these concepts of who we are, grasping at these identities, actually limits us.
So this whole talk about man and woman is limiting us from actually getting to a deeper truth.
Yeah. I mean, because when you really want to talk about the nature of reality, it has nothing to do with men and women. And it has nothing
Not
to
at
do
its
with,
core.
With this or that, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, so much of my training is, you know, you have this idea of who you are. Well, that's a wrong idea of who you are. Throw it out.
So,
yeah. I mean, for example, if I were to give some other examples about identity. Okay.
Thanks.
So people look at me and they say, you're American. Okay. So what about me makes me an American? Is it my accent? You know, is this body American? So it said, made in America.
There's very few things.
Yeah. Outsourced to China.
Well, your ordination. Yeah. Taiwanese.
So, you know, so why am I American? Or on what basis do we say I'm American? It's simply because I have an American passport. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason I'm American. Does being American mean you have to have a certain political view or a certain view towards what kind of government we should have or anything? No, we have all sorts of diversity here. Mm-hmm. So I'm American simply because I have an American passport.
Right.
So I'm not going to get into this, you know, latched on idea of America as the one superpower. I'm a citizen of the one superpower and we're going to control the world. Excuse me. I don't want to be involved in that. You know, and I'm not going, we have the biggest military in the world. I'm so proud of my country. No.
No, it's just another spot on the beautiful earth
spot
that we live on.
Yeah, and I value the values that this country was founded on. You know, it's just, it took me a while to realize that, you know, what was it, equality? What's our thing? We did this just the other day. Something in the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yep.
You know, that's what I learned. Third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. It took me a while to realize that they forgot the rest of the sentence, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, as long as you are male, white, Christian, and rich.
Yes. That was a given.
Yeah.
or something.
You know? So now I think this country is like, wait a minute, you didn't put the rest of that in the Constitution. So we got to, you know, take it out of our minds now.
Yes.
Yeah, and really make this country equal.
Yes, yeah. to the rest of the world and within our own hearts and minds. Yes.
Within our own hearts and minds. So that, you know, yeah, if one person is discriminated against in this country, it's like all of us being discriminated against.
I feel that in the whole world, right? Yeah. If anybody is discriminated, but I believe I'm unique compared to, I mean, on you know, it's not the mainstream viewpoint,
yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
And I did serve in the Peace Corps.
Oh, wonderful.
Right after I graduated from college.
Great.
And was in Lesotho, a small country in the middle of South Africa. It was a fabulous experience.
Wonderful.
And it didn't take me long to be there to realize that I came from such a gifted part of this earth, so rich in resources alone, you know, like running water, not only running water, but water that's in most places we can find it easily and good soil and things like this. I was working on a gardening program. And I thought, as a young person in my early 20s, that I had a responsibility, being from this country, to share this or do whatever I could to help others who weren't born into such rich resources.
Yeah.
And I feel the Buddhist tradition takes that as well, no matter where you're born.
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
Interesting. But sometimes I feel as a woman in my own journey here that it's like it's a very natural tendency to want to help and to want to care for, and it's almost as if my natural tendency as a woman looks at it a little bit differently than a man would. But it could just be that my own unique individual person, not because I'm a woman, but that I see things more, I look at more aspects of the picture as opposed to like, this is the solution from A to B.
Right, right. So, I mean, on one hand, people might say, well, that's biologically because, you know, women take care of kids and, you know, have to think about other living beings. As, you know, so people could make that argument. But then you have men that are like that, and then you have women that aren't like that.
Yes, exactly. I believe we're all on a spectrum.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what sex you were born into or not.
Yeah.
That we all think or act just as our own unique being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, my question was just, if you had any last comments or anything that really you would like to, you know, this is going out on the radio waves, anything that you would, you know, really like to offer beyond anything we've...
I think it's very important in being a whole person that we learn how to think for ourselves and that we spend some time really thinking, what are my values? What are my principles? How do I want to live? Yeah. So instead of letting what other people think or what society thinks or what political leaders are saying push us in one direction and make us narrow-minded, yeah, or make us adopt identities that we then cling to, I think it's very important to you know, be able to step back and think about what kind of person we want to be and then recondition ourselves to become that kind of person. So, for example, when we were little, as little girls, we may have been told, well, girls do this and they don't do that. But then now we're adults, we can think for ourselves. How much do we think that's true? Or do we think it's not true? Or to what extent is it true? To what extent is it false? Or depending on your family, what you grow up with, believing, you know, certain things about certain groups of people, and then becoming an adult and thinking, is that true or is that not true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do I want to be a person who evaluates people based on their social class, their ethnicity, their race, their religion, and so on? What kind of human being do I want to be? And, you know, so we've had all this conditioning when we were little kids, but now we're adults, and we can think for ourselves. And I think it's important to do that, and not just jump on the bandwagon. Especially, you know, given the way the whole political scene in the country right mm-hmm. now, I feel like it's so destructive.
Oh, yes.
You know, to the country and also to individuals. It's, you know, what I see, what's going on with the Republican primary, it's, wow. You know, I remember in the past when I was little, the politicians comported themselves with more dignity. Maybe they still were the same, I mean, they probably still the same level of corruption, but they were more dignified about it and not so blatantly racist or rude.
They seem like little children that have been hurt.
Yes, very much. And so I think, you know, in that ambience, we have to really think, what kind of person do I want to be? And be that. And not let this other stuff influence us. And talk about our beliefs to others, you know, if our beliefs are ones of inclusion and compassion and respect and kindness and care for each other. Yeah. Which are values of all religions. You know, you look, I don't care, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, the same values of kindness, compassion, love, you know, forgiveness, their ethical conduct, they're there in all the religions. Yeah. So instead of making our religion some kind of identity like a football team that we root for and we're prejudiced against other religions and yeah. so on, it's like, let's practice our own faith and have a warm, opening heart towards everybody.
Well, yeah. that seems to be yeah. at the core of all teachings.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't studied them all, but the ones I've looked at.
It's in there with all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and not to let the people who misunderstand their own religions speak for those religions.
Right, right.
Yeah.
From what I understand of the Buddhist teachings, they deserve just as much compassion, and it almost feels like more so compassion than the people that seem to be more successful being kind. So I'm right. So let me in the Bodhi, from what I understand of the Bodhicitta and uh-huh. Bodhisattva path,
yeah.
is to help relieve suffering of all sentient beings.
Right.
And even I did read on, and if you want to talk about a little bit of the violence that recently happened in Paris, and I read mm-hmm. what you wrote about that even the perpetrators deserve
compassion
in our kindness
yeah.
because they're only they're like naive children that are separate from knowing the truth of who they are.
Yeah. And they're creating tremendous negativity, which
right.
will cause them suffering.
Right.
Yeah. So, and they must have had minds full of suffering. Otherwise, who would do this kind of thing?
I don't think anybody yeah. could unless yeah. they had such suffering.
But you know what? I'm not so much afraid of ISIS terrorism. I'm afraid of homegrown people like the guy who did the shootout yesterday in Colorado Springs.
I missed that. I
there was some guy, white man, yeah. Not that it matters, but I had to say it because to undo the stereotypes that, oh, he was probably a minority.
Right.
No, he wasn't.
Right.
He was white, 57 years old. Went outside a Planned Parenthood clinic, started shooting people in the parking lot, went into the clinic, shooting people. There was a standoff between him and the police that lasted almost 6 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Either 9 or 11 people were killed. Oh. One was a police officer. I think 3 or 4 other officers were injured. 2 civilians were died, others injured. And every week we're reading about some kind of shootout somewhere in our country.
Yes.
We don't read about a terrorist attack in our country every week.
No, but that's terrorism.
But that's terrorism, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And, there's a school shooting almost every week. They don't all make it to the press. So I'm much more concerned with the popularity of guns in our culture and what happens with them.
I mean, especially right here in northern Washington and northern Idaho, right? Like, it's expected that you have a gun.
Yeah.
And you should know how to use it. And it's an interesting, and so it's a breath of fresh air for me to come to such a, abbey such as here that I believe, doesn't really need guns and practices different beliefs. So how do you, what is your stance on it, or what do you do? Like, so when you got that news yesterday, what is it that you will practice, or what do you do with that information?
What do? I use it to generate compassion.
And can you?
Yeah. Well, of course, I do prayers for the people who died.
Right.
Yeah. But I also, look at this guy who did it. They had his photo in the paper. I look on the internet. This guy, problems.
Yeah.
Problems. Yeah. And I just think, wow, what kind of mind must somebody have to think that doing that would bring them happiness? And I think of the, because we talk about karma and the results of our actions, because our actions have an ethical dimension. So, what he's going to experience in this life, after this life, and then you can't help but have compassion. And then the hardest thing in it is for me to have compassion for the lawmakers who do nothing about the situation. That is the hardest thing for me to have compassion. For people who have the power in society to not use it to make things better.
Yeah.
He had an assault rifle.
Right. Why do people need assault rifles?
Yeah.
And for me to have compassion for the bullet making company and the assault rifle making company and those CEOs who the greatest ones that I need to find compassion for.
Yeah.
And so when you try to find what kind of mind would allow that to happen, is it that you identify somewhere within yourself?
Yeah. If I were to behave like that, what would be motivating it?
Right.
And then I can see, it's obviously greed and anger and ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that motivating them. But then if I look at myself, am I free of greed and anger and ignorance? No.
No.
So I can't place myself above those people.
No, just because it comes out in different acts doesn't make it lesser or greater.
Right. I've got to work on myself and diminish those qualities in myself.
And through your practice, you work on those through your prayers.
Through our meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, through our community life and our discussions and teachings.
Because those things will arise in community.
You bet they arise.
We just were talking about that at lunch.
And then we have to, you know, work with our own minds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And hearts.
And heart. When I say mind, it includes hearts.
Okay, all right. Interesting. Right, because that can be distinguished in different
places. Buddhist language, they're the same thing. In Western language, we say mind, heart, and a brick wall.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But in Buddhist language, the one word can be translated into English as heart, like somebody has a kind heart, or as mind, somebody has a good mind.
A conscious mind. And what about soul?
We don't talk about soul.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no idea of a permanent person.
A permanent person, yet you believe in reincarnation?
Yes, yes.
And so what part would have another
life? The continuity of consciousness.
So that's how you talk about it.
But the continuity of consciousness is changing every moment.
Absolutely.
And it's not a fixed person.
Right, so this continuity of consciousness is changing each moment from this beautiful interaction I get to have right now and others.
Uh-huh.
And so in another, once this body perishes, that consciousness
can be reborn.
Can be, but not, doesn't necessarily...
Well, it depends, you know, on your level of spiritual attainment.
Uh-huh.
Our idea is to not be reborn under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment.
Right.
But to be able to manifest in the world under the influence of wisdom and compassion to be of benefit.
Right.
That's our goal.
Which is what we see that His Holiness, the Dalai Lama... And I guess, as you can tell, we talk more and I get more and more interested, more and more questions. I did read at the end of your interview just that the Dalai Lama had said that it is possible that the next...
Oh, that's just...
Okay, we don't even want to...
That's just like...
Silliness, got you.
But this book, read that. That will help you with your question.
I will. And what I've read, you are very clear and precise in the way you present. And thank you so much. Thank you for this time.
Sure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yin Radio. That was an interview with the Venerable Thubten Chodron that Eva Johavik traveled up to Newport, Washington to do. And the book, I believe she's referring to at the end, there is An Open-Hearted Life. And the Venerable Chodron was in Moscow region a little earlier in the fall. And she came and presented actually on this book. So An Open-Hearted Life, I know the Book People does carry this. So if you wanted to read further, as well as going to her website, thubtenchodron.org, that's thubtenchodron.org. And finally, she is the abbess at the Sravasti Abbey, and that website is sravastiabbey.org, sravastiabbey.org. I don't know for you how you find that, but there's one element I just felt like emphasizing before we do close for the day for Yin Radio, at a time where there's so much discussion about what is going on, of course, in the world as a whole. One of the things that I think comes across so strongly in this interview and really this dialogue between two women, both committed to exploring their own inner worlds and the outer world and coming from a place of peace and compassion, as well as meeting in an environment dedicated to that. So something I hear in that dialogue together is something I'd love to hear more of in our world as a whole, and that is that willingness to be open to the discussion itself, open to the emotions that come with that discussion all across the board, recognizing that each one of us as humans has the full spectrum of emotion, and that ability to then identify into that, to feel the pain. You know, it's hard not sometimes to jump right into anger as a result of pain. And so I think when we can come together and speak so openly, and really, really raise ideas and concepts from the point of view of let's find ways to work with these and acknowledge within our own selves where these feelings might lie in larger or smaller elements, and then to share that compassion back across humanity. And of course, we've done a lot of interviews in the environmental humanities of late, so interspecies elements as well, which also are a part of the Buddhist tradition. And again, if you go online and look through the Venerable Shodron's website, you'll find a broad spectrum across the environmental element, across the humanities, across all realms. So I do hope you'll go and have a look and just have a chance to listen to more of her wisdom, especially right now where I think in our discussions again of late, we need some other ways of speaking to the hard elements of what we are currently facing in this world. So thank you so much for being here with us today on Yin Radio. And thank you very much to the Venerable Chodron, to Damcho, who arranged all this through the Abbey as well, who was just phenomenal and just gave me a sheer smile every time I communicated with her. And of course, to Eva Johalvik for both traveling to do the interview and also holding space, which is again the last element which she and I spoke of before the interview and then after, and what that really means to just be present and hold a space, not have to have all the answers, but be able to follow within the moment. Again, sort of a Buddhist element in and of itself, but also an element that might help us carry forward in these times that are more difficult, right? So living on that paradox of having some control and no control at all, difficult place to be, but amazing things that can come from that space. So this is KRFP Moscow Pullman 90.3. You've been listening to Yin Radio. My name is Tara K. Howe. Join us in another couple weeks on December 20th again from 2 to 3 p.m. And go online at any time to yinradioblog.wordpress.com to find out what's upcoming, as well as accessing all of our show archives. And please do find us on Facebook. It's Yin Radio. And I would love to hear from you in regards to all of our shows and have a more engaging dialogue from that forum. So thank you so much. And we will see you again or speak with you again in another couple weeks.